Hi, this is Paul. This is sort of a words that fudge video, and it's a video about the resurrection because I want to talk about the word reality. And I'm going to pull together just a bunch of stuff that I've continued to be thinking about as I process all the Jordan Peterson stuff and all the John Vervaeke stuff. And I'm just so appreciative to both these men for putting out what they've put out and sharing and just keeping the wheels turning and keeping thoughts going on in my head. Now, this word reality, where does it come from? Well, property, possession. Well, that's interesting. Real estate, you might notice that connection anyway. Definitions are something about, the state of being actual. And actual is funny because actual is right here, right now, or real. Well, reality, using real to define reality, that doesn't seem quite right. The reality of an event, the ultimate reality of life, the world or the state of things as they actually exist. Again, that's a very now, actually, as opposed to idealistically or notionally. One of the more interesting notions here is, one of the most interesting definitions here is number five, obsolete, loyalty, devotion. Thomas Fuller, to express our realty to the emperor. That's a very interesting definition. Synonyms: truth, actuality. You can see even just from the definition of this word, we have a hard time pinning this thing down, and as opposed to fantasy, which of course leads to the struggle that we have with the idea of myth. Now, my go-to quotes from Peterson is what he said, shared with Roger Scruton, in terms of just a real brief. Just basically, again and again, he says, the world is too big. We can't capture the whole world. So what we do is we capture these low resolution impressions and memories, and they're not always pictures or thing or of objects. You can see reality in this referential sense of it that we often use in terms of truth. And in the video I did of talking about the Boghossian podcast, I went through some of the Vervaeke interview where he talked about this family of knowledge. There's propositional truth, there's techne or procedural knowledge, there's perspectival knowledge, there's participatory knowledge, and there's probably more. But this little quote from Peterson that I use quite often, I think is very helpful.
Well, I think it's useful as an adjunct to that. So Roger mentioned that the transcendent is what we bump up against when we realize our ignorance. And so it's that which transcends our ignorance. And that in itself makes it an implacable fact, unless you believe that you have no ignorance, in which case there's no point in furthering a discussion with you. So the transcendent is the fact insofar as it's that which transcends our ignorance. But you can also think about it technically. So, and I think we know enough about how the brain works now, so that, not that we know much, so that useful things can be said about that. You tend to represent the world in the simplest manner that you possibly can that works for what you're doing. And so you don't actually see the world. You see sufficiently useful, low resolution representations of the world. And if they work, then that's fine. There's no need to adjust them, and they're relatively easy to remember and to manipulate. But now and then you have a misapprehension about someone, let's say, and you have a conversation with them, and the conversation goes sideways. And what that means is that the thing that you thought you were conversing with is not the thing that you're conversing with, and that manifests itself in error. Right? So error is the place where the transcendent reveals itself. And what is actually revealing itself is the reality that's outside and underneath your perceptions. And so what you see in the world, in some sense, is a set of animated cartoons. And a lot of that is actually a consequence of you seeing nothing but your memory, because your brain is organized so that instead of going through all of the difficulty of having to look at the thing in itself, you look at what you assume to be there. And if you can get away with that, so much the better. But the thing in itself is always much richer than your apprehension of it, which is partly why you make mistakes, but also partly why you can continue to garner wisdom in the world. There's always more there than meets the eye. And God only knows how much more there's there than meets the eye. And you can show this even in the religious sense to some degree.
Okay, and then he goes on from there, and that's, I played that clip quite a bit. And so you have this idea that, oh, my little, I'm in the way of my little illustration. Oh, maybe I'll put myself over here. There we go. So we have this idea of, you know, we see this world and it's out there and it's rich and it's full. And of course, even a tiny little scene like this, where the dog is trying to get the cat out of his bed, and, you know, the dog eventually wins. And I explained to my children that, you know, if the dog starts to lose these battles, the dog's in real trouble, because he can only see out of one eye. And, you know, the only thing going for him is his mouth is bigger than the cat, and the cat's mouth. And he can never catch the cat because the cat's way faster and more agile. And but the dog's got to keep going. But anyway, so we take this huge world and we select, and this is where you get the salience. We select that which is important, and that which is important because of our desire, that which is important because of our need, that, you know, we have opportunities and threats. You have all of this stuff going on, and we compress it down into these tiny low resolution, you know, drawings or movies. They're actually very tiny, and they're in our heads, but they're not even just pictures of objects out there. They're impressions and smells and memories. I mean, all of this stuff going on, but it all has to get incredibly compressed and condensed so that it can fit in our head in a movable way. And I love the way Peterson talks about how this is, you know, this is useful for us, and this is how it has to work. Now, here's my little, probably 2-year-old self somewhere at the beach getting a sunburn that will give me skin cancer someday, because we didn't know about that. But here I am at the Jersey Shore sleeping away, and you know, one of my parents thought this was cute, so took a picture of me. We all have this experience of dreaming, and dreams seem real. So we're going to talk about this word reality. Dreams seem real. And sometimes when you're dreaming, you kind of figure out, no, this is dreaming. And then sometimes you have inception-like dreaming. Sometimes if I wake up early in the morning and I don't want to bother my wife, I'll put in a podcast, and I'll just put in a podcast and put headphones on and lay in bed. And then sometimes I'll fall back asleep, and then I'll have the experience of sleeping, and I'm hearing, you know, whoever's on the, you know, Jordan Peterson or John Vervaeke or Tim Keller or someone just talking. And it's like, why is this voice happening? And then sometimes, like Inception, the voice will colonize my dream. And then at some point they'll say, oh, I've got to stop this. And so then I try and turn it off on my phone in the dream, and it still doesn't turn off. And I just have to come up far enough to realize, no, wait a minute, I'm actually in bed and this is in my ears. So then I'll reach down and turn it off, or I'll wake up or something like that. And so it's funny how we have these levels of reality and these layers of reality. And I was talking to my friend James, who comes to the meetups. And James is he's got a PhD in neuropsychology, and he's talking about, you know, are we always dreaming during the day? I mean, this kind of gets into Peterson's point that our mind is always putting up these images, but while we're awake and engaged in the world, there's this much broader connected image of the world outside of ourselves, which is not subject to our control, and somehow these two worlds meet. And this is actually, as we'll get into a little bit later, this is what Don Hoffman calls the interface that we are actually connecting with. And so we see things that we want to see, and we don't see things that aren't relevant to us. And I mean, all this vast complexity going on all the time, and this experience of what we're witnessing, this is reality. Okay, and if you're a long time ago, I referenced The Heretic, which was in the Weekly Standard, an article about Thomas Nagel. This, and it talked about this manifest image, and I often had that portrayed to me quite vividly when I had a good friend of mine who was spending a lot of time around the church, but he had very low sight, and he explained to me that he really kind of looked out through a tube, and that's all he could see. And he also was losing his hearing, and so I'd walk up to him next time. I'd walk up to him sometimes. I'd be standing right next to him, and he didn't know I was there. And suddenly, I would say something or do something, and like, pow! I popped into his world like Barbara Eden and I Dream of Jeannie, and he'd pull a start back, and he'd be like, "Don't scare me like that." And, sorry, Brandon. This weird relationship with reality that we have. Now, what's interesting about the dream world, sometimes you can have vivid dreaming where you can kind of impose your will on the dream world and sort of like Neo in the Matrix, make things unfold and happen like you want them to. But this layer of reality, this dream world, gets pierced and threatened by the alarm clock or the dog or a kid crying or the podcast. And it's so interesting how one level colonizes the other. And so the alarm clock is more real than my dream in a certain sense. It isn't that the dream isn't real, just that the alarm clock is more real. Well, how does the physical world and the dream world relate? I talked about that a little bit before, and maybe one of these days I'll have my friend James come on, and he'll do his little shtick about the fact that we don't really dream. And it gets into this question that, right already, even though my mind imagines I'm seeing everything out here in my messy office, the truth is I'm not. My eyes aren't even physically seeing it. My brain is sort of filling in the gaps, and that's the same reason, and you learn this when you're a grade school kid, cover one eye, and there is a blind spot, and you can, play little tricks to find your blind spot, but your brain just fills it in and creates this image for us. And of course, only a little portion of our eye really has that high resolution, and our eyes are actually always moving, and it's darting around. And if I want to focus on something, there I do. I can focus right on it, but the rest of my eye is considerably low resolution because my brain can only handle so much, and this much we know. So is the dream world dependent on the physical world? Now, this, of course, is the great debate. This is the question of consciousness, and this is the hard problem of consciousness. But we do know that they are certainly connected. Okay, so whether we're going to use the radio image that our brains are sort of like cell phones or radios, and they're picking up transmissions, or whether it's all generated from our head, whether consciousness is far more common than I would know. I remember in the Jordan Peterson Sam Harris conversations, Sam Harris was postulating about computers and consciousness. Well, how would you know your PC isn't conscious? And this gets into Brett Weinstein's idea of a programmed robot. Well, if my PC starts talking back to me, well, it does talk back to me, talks back to me all the time, and I can talk to Siri or Cortana, or I don't know why Google doesn't give itself some cool name. I have to say it. I don't want to say it because then my phone and my computer are going to talk to me. But, on and on and on. So, what's the relationship between what is consciousness? Where does it come from? I mean, we can't really answer that question, but we know that consciousness is real. And there's something important about the physical world that we don't want to lose, however, and we all instinctively know this. We maintain this, I'm going to get to this slide a little bit later, but we maintain this bias for the real world. If your son or your daughter is spending all of their time looking at screens or on the internet or engaging in a virtual world, parents have problems. Well, Peterson was about ready in that clip to talk about psychedelics. If you could just put yourself on a perpetual psychedelic trip and lay in bed, think about Soma and Brave New World, lay in bed for the rest of your life. Do you think that would be a good thing? Or do we have a bias about the physical world that somehow this is important and something that we ought not to lose? And someone who perhaps, let's say they're uncomfortable, they'd say, well, maybe we'll put them in a dream state for the rest of their life. Well, we would call that what? A vegetative state? There's the part of the difficulty of consciousness is, we're not exactly sure what all is going on in the brain. We look at different waves, and we correlate those things to different other waves when we're awake and what we can report to. But, we've got a lot of questions about these things. Now, In John Vervaeke's most recent, he had a really good, I think, a really good treatment of Gnosticism, and as always, he dropped some really good resources in there. And so I'm gonna play a little bit about this, and a little bit from this class.
Now, this idea that spirituality is ultimately about transcending the gods rather than serving the gods is very, it's very both pertinent to us today and very radical for its time, because you have basically the challenging of a, not even a belief, it was just an unquestioned presupposition that our relationship to the gods was one of servitude and slavery, getting transformed into, no, the core of spirituality is not worship. The core of spirituality is self-transcendence.
What he said right there, even though he's talking about ancient Gnosticism, there's a tremendous amount of, many, many people would say that. The core of, and when people say, I don't go to church because I'm spiritual but not religious, in many ways, that's exactly what they're saying. I'm looking for self-transcendence. I'm looking to try to transcend the suffering and struggles of my life, the things that bother me. That's exactly how many people today are defining spirituality, or the spirituality they are seeking and hoping to live within.
Healing and freeing people from existential entrapment and their suffering, and that our mythology and our practices should always be in service of us reuniting to who and what we are. Now
we get into the secret sacred self for many people. Again, on that same language, they would say, "Well, I'm trying to connect with who I really am. That there's a true me that has been disconnected from me, and now through these spiritual practices, through these transformative practices, I now am going to connect up with that true me. And then when I realize the true me, I will increasingly become the true me, and I will transcend from my secret sacreds to my, I will transcend my current existence into this true self." And obviously he's talking about Gnosticism here.
We love this story. Notice how, first of all, it's still got all the Platonic elements. Here are the people trapped in the cave, they're bound, they get the secret knowledge, right, that frees them so that they can return to and see the light, right? But of course, for Plato, you come back down into the cave. For the Gnostics, you try to spread the message to as many people as you can. So it has the Platonism. It, of course, has a way of connecting that Platonism to Christianity by reinterpreting Jesus as the embodiment of Gnosis rather than as a sacrifice in whom we should have faith. Jesus is a teacher who provides us with something like what the shaman did and what our therapist does, provides us with the keys to unlocking. Right, unlock.
And this is something I hear quite a bit from New Age friends who, I can learn a lot from Jesus. Jesus is, in a sense, my guide, my spirit guide into this. And John is just articulating exactly ancient Gnosticism, but also a certain amount of contemporary Gnosticism.
Talking all the ways in which these patterns, these sociocultural, political, economic patterns, ways of thinking and being, are just permeated into layers of our psyche and ways of being in the world, that they just exacerbate our suffering, our existential entrapment, and the way it is fragmenting our world and ripping apart our agency. So we long for that now. This was Hans Jonas' great insight. We long for that now. So we go to movies that show this, right? So DeConnick goes through several movies that are basically modern portrayals of this Gnostic mythology. Of course, famously, and it brings all of these elements in, The Christian, The the Platonic and the Gnostic, of course, is the Matrix. Right? Because the Matrix is this. You're entrapped in a world of illusion. There are evil overlords who are trying to keep you entrapped so you don't ever discover who you truly are, right? But you know, remember there's a scene in the movie, like a splinter in your mind that there is something wrong and you don't belong, right? That's the Matrix. Or you can see a movie starring Jim Carrey, The Truman Story. Notice, of course, the play on words there. Right, Truman, discovering who you really are. And he grows up in a world, right, with an overlord that has manufactured.
And the overlord's name, Christus. Christus.
To keep him from ever actually getting his true agency, finding true love, etc. And what he has to do is get the knowledge in order to get beyond this God. We keep telling this story because it's a myth, because it keeps pointing us to patterns that are pervasive and profound and powerful. And we can't quite articulate them and we can't quite know them. But the myth at least gives us a moment of, right, at least narrative and symbolic recognition of our suffering.
Probably makes the point. So anyway, watch the whole thing. So you have the self-transcendence, and that's the goal. And so we seek strategies and vehicles for experiencing the self-transcendence. And you ultimately want to live in it, where you master you. And this is where we get into the circular me that I was referring to with Brett Weinstein's idea of, well, I'm programmed as an assassin robot, but all I need to do is deny my programming. And in fact, if you watch The Matrix, that's the entire struggle that Neo is dealing with. So after Morpheus releases him from the, you know, unplugs him from the Matrix, and then they plug him into their training program, Morpheus keeps basically telling Neo, trying to show him in the context of the program, this is how, you know, you're just in a program. This is just a building. This is not ultimate reality. And the entire point of the Matrix is that Neo realizes that, you know, he can dominate this reality. And it's a, you know, of course, the first of the three movies was the best, but it's a very powerful image. And even as I mentioned, I'm going to mention my Sunday school class that I taught last week, because I wound up teaching this stuff, which is sort of the way it works in my Sunday school class, because a little bit later we'll get into what is a gospel. But you get into these questions of, okay, well, what is real? What is reality? Is the dream real? Yeah, the dream is real. It's a real dream, but the alarm clock is more real. And my little famous now cell phone holder, this is quite real. But in a sense, I, as the agent in this world, am more real still, because conscious agents with plans who created the formal cause, and, you know, you look at Aristotle's four causes, you know, devised this and mined the ore and, you know, composed, you know, created the metal to have these certain qualities. So it's quite rigid, and, you know, dust, you put this coating on it so it doesn't, you know, it doesn't rust. And this is probably aluminum. Maybe not, I don't know. And you know, you put this hole in it so that back in the day when I bought this, you could have your power plug go in here, and you could have the wire go through there if you wanted it to. So it's just a nice little cell phone holder. But we've got all of this design in it. So in a way, this is real. But the colonization, the formation of this is in a way more real than the thing itself, because it controls it. It sets its destiny. And someday this will head to a landfill and live in a landfill for who knows how long, probably until Jesus comes again or some future generation digs it up and says, I could use this metal. Now, as I said before, we have this business about virtual reality. A bunch of people pointed me to this video that's sort of gone viral, where a real pastor, I just watched the language, a real pastor, so I guess this is guy's a pastor in real life, but he's in some virtual reality room, sort of like the Matrix, and Drumzy, he baptizes Drumzy, who's kind of an anime figure, an anime girl, and baptizes her in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. But of course, these are two people sitting in virtual reality rooms, hundreds or dozens or thousands of miles apart, and there's no real water. And so here they have a virtual reality baptism. But notice how the poster of the video quite smartly says real pastor instead of virtual pastor. And we used real pastor to mean someone who actually has flesh, not a computer simulation. We maintain a bias for connection with the physical world. And so even though in some ways the engineers and the business, see, the engineers are both physical and mental, they have mind, but the business that created this, well, it has manifestations in paper and office buildings, but the business itself is not real in the sense that this is real. But yet the business is more real in that, in a sense, it produces it. So the talking about reality is not a simple thing. Is the business more real, or is the cell phone holder more real? Well, it depends what you mean by real. Well, in this case, is the baptism real when it's done in virtual reality? Now, if you listen to the video, you'll hear the pastor talk about, all of these. The water is God's love, and he's making up a fair amount. Well, I'll not criticize his theology right now, but I watched and all kinds of thoughts go through my head as this guy is doing his baptism. Would you find a virtual heaven sufficiently satisfying? And actually, often when I talk about the ways in which a lot of contemporary churches in America are Gnostic. Their eschatology is Gnostic because they say something like, well, basically, when you die, you go to heaven to be with Jesus. Well, what about your body? Well, your body stays in the ground. Well, what are you in heaven? Well, I'm a consciousness. I'm a free-floating consciousness. It's like I'm a virtual reality avatar, but that's, there's no reality to me. And every Easter I'll talk about this, and I'll differentiate this from what I think is Orthodox Christianity, which is the belief in the resurrection. Now, part of this is because in most cases, our virtual worlds are dependent on our physical world. So there's actually a server someplace that is hosting this meetup room. Each of these people have their own computers, they have their own virtual reality headsets. And so once again, the virtual world is dependent on the physical world in cases like this. But again, when we get to consciousness, the questions get tricky. Now, this is in a way where we get into the simulation argument because, well, what if we are quickly getting to the point that we can imagine fooling ourselves with representations we create on computers? And there's a thing called the Turing test, which was developed by Alan Turing in 1950, and it's a test of a machine's ability to exhibit intelligent behavior equivalent to or indistinguishable from a human being. And right now they've often tried to do this through speech, and they keep doing this and saying, when will we get to the point that we can fool human beings and have them talking to a computer, but they think they're talking to another human being? And this gets very complicated in terms of definition, but this always sort of leans us into the simulation argument. And of course, this still is from Elon Musk at the Recode conference, where Josh Topolsky asks him, what are the odds that we're in base reality? Well, what do you mean by base reality? The reality where, like the alarm clock does to the dream, or like on the Nebuchadnezzar, which was the name of the Matrix hovercraft, where, I forget what's his head, unplugs his fellow soldiers and kills them by unplugging them when they're in the Matrix, because it's like their brain is supposed to be in two places or something like that. But the Nebuchadnezzar in the Matrix is base reality, and the servers and all the computer systems that, in a sense, is base reality upon which the virtual reality is dependent upon. So Elon Musk is asked, you know, what are the odds that we're in virtual reality? Well, basically, the argument from the simulation goes, how likely is it that we, meaning us right here, got there first? Or is it more likely that someone else did, and that we are now, and that we are not living in base reality? And that's, Elon Musk says, billions to one, which is, wow, that's quite a stark statement. And that the problem with the simulation argument is that it leads us to imagining that this consciousness we're experiencing is the product of some kid's PC in a basement playing a really long computer game, or that we would simulate ourselves, or that aliens are simulating. And you see right away, what we are doing is concocting these alternate realities based on our own brains and imagining things based on the furniture of our own world. And that's not really what I think about when I think about the simulation argument. I think about basically a different fact, which is that what if, in fact, well, we've been talking about this throughout pretty much the history of philosophy. And when I talked about Paul Maxwell's video, you know, this wonderful little video where you could chart out the history of philosophy. You know, ancient philosophy has metaphysics, modern philosophy focuses on epistemology, postmodern philosophy focuses on axiology. Metaphysics, what is base reality? That's the question. And so the Greeks were talking about that, and Plato was talking about that. It's the forms, and Aristotle kind of brings it back down to earth, and the pre-Socratics, you know, it's change, it's the swerve, it's, you know, Heraclitus, all of these philosophers asking, what is base reality? And by the time we get to Descartes, we have modern philosophy, and now we're just basically focusing on epistemology. How can we have knowledge? And then post, you know, it's interesting because as this history of philosophy develops, we get more and more skeptical, because by the time we hit the modern period, well, we can't know base reality, so let's just camp on epistemology. And by the time you get to postmodernity, well, all that epistemology is corrupt because we're all motivated, and so what must we do? And off a thousand other conversations go. But if we get down to both Donald Hoffman and Jordan Peterson, Donald Hoffman in his TED Talk, which you can find, Do We See Reality as It Is? Donald Hoffman says no, evolutionarily not. We are not tooled to see reality as it is, Donald Hoffman asserts, but we are tooled for tricks and hacks, Donald Hoffman says. And that's not actually far from what Jordan Peterson says in terms of, well, we see this low resolution image that's good enough to help us get in the world. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't a reality out there that we're engaging with, but it's Donald Hoffman says there's an interface. Well, that sounds kind of weird, but if you stop and you think about, well, I'm using my eyes, and as I get older, my eyes are, you know, less and less, my eyes are not what they were 20 years ago. They're still pretty good. I still don't have to wear glasses, but they're not what they were 20 years ago. And so sometimes text is a little bit fuzzy and I have to hold things out a little bit far, but it's good enough for what I need to do. And if I need to do something a little bit better, I'll take a pair of reading glasses and I'll put that on, and then it'll be a little bit better. And so, well, it's an interface that I use. And we know that dogs' eyes don't see like our eyes do. Flies' eyes don't see like our eyes do. Certain shrimp can see more colors than we can see. Some women can see more colors than men can see. You know, so on and so forth. That we don't, but we see enough to be able to manipulate and to interact with this reality, with this stuff, with this world outside ourselves, but we are in fact engaging in an interface of sorts. And the interface is actually, it's built into us. Peterson's a prior argument in terms of his conversation with Sam Harris, but it's a meeting between the two worlds in a sense. So we use a priori sorting mechanism to see the world. And, you know, again, if you go back to Verveke stuff, I look at this and it's graspable, and graspability is not a property of this thing itself necessarily. It's something that we bring into it in terms of when we're all together. And here's a clock. And you know, graspability, but if I were going to throw something, well, it depends on, this has various aspects of graspability for me, but it's kind of light, and this is a little bit heavier, and so we have all these qualities, and of course, I've got the stapler's pretty heavy. I got all these things, but other things aren't nearly as graspable. Well, you know, this tripod, well, this is kind of graspable, but this is swingable. You know, and you've got all these, and this is sort of mountable. And so you have all these properties that are here, and then I look at my water bottle. My water bottle is very graspable, and, you know, all of this is built in. On we go. And then a little bit of this video with Rupert Sheldrake, who's a very interesting character. And he walks through, and this video, Is There Something Rather Than Nothing? And he quotes Lawrence Krauss's book, Is There Something Rather, you know, Is There Something, dealing with Is There Something Rather Than Nothing? And he notes that actually the atheist physicists and scientists have pretty much a similar argument as religious people. They just get really annoyed at religious language because supposedly laws of nature are pre-existent and universal, which is sort of like the logos, as you would find in John 1 and Genesis 1. Well, John 1 written over into Genesis 1, and this quantum vacuum, which is sort of energy, is basically the spirit that's blowing over the wind, that's blowing over the waters, and boom, there you have creation. The only question, of course, is the difference of mind and personal or impersonal. So you have all this volatility or non-volatility, and so really the great divide is whether something is personal or impersonal. And what I increasingly bump into is that we are deeply troubled by the question of whether or not there is a will greater than our own. Now, this to me, this fascinates me, because as Thomas Nagel tries to get at with his book Mind and Cosmos, we've sort of reached the end of this objectivistic approach to the world, and we recognize that unless we bring in subjectivity one way or another, we really can't find a path forward. But we don't really want there to be a God. Because, well, why? Because a God is going to be doing picking and choosing, and we don't want a God, we don't want anybody else picking and choosing for us, especially not someone we trust. And maybe if they're other human beings, maybe we'll think they're people of goodwill, and so on and so forth. But we hope to be the top willful agent, or at least be part of that class. And we look around and imagine, if I, as a moral agent, were planning the universe, I would do so with less suffering and less waste. And in fact, almost every debate I hear between apologists and celebrity atheists has this subtext running beneath it, that I am more moral than any God you might imagine or find in the Bible. And then so often the apologists are kind of backtracking and trying to, you know, spruce up. They're, in a sense, the rider on the back of the God elephant, and they're trying to improve his reputation by reading Bible verses in one way or another. And I've done the same thing. But what this is all really built on is 1,000 years of Christianity that you really need to have the problem of evil that we have today. Well, why do I say that? Because if you had, pretty much like the ancients or other civilizations around the world, if you looked out into nature, you wouldn't be under any idea that nature should be good to you. In fact, nature was horribly dangerous for you, and you had to do everything you could just to stay alive. You didn't have a meaning crisis, but you sure wanted to eat. So what happens, I think, after 1,000 years of Christianity, after all of this messaging that, well, God number one, the God of the universe, is good and it's built in, well, suddenly we're thinking, nah, we could do better. And if there is a God, you know, certainly we wouldn't have all this waste. If we were running a simulation, we would make it much happier for the people. Of course, you can watch The Matrix. They actually discuss that in that movie, too. All of these ideas we actually get from the Gospels. Well, what are the Gospels? So the Gospels are these books, these four books at the beginning of the New Testament that have the stories of Jesus. And I'm just starting in my adult Sunday school class a study on the Gospel of John. And so I begin with it asking about what the Gospels are. C.S. Lewis has a really nice little write-up on Gospels. Come on, Microsoft, you can do it. What's the deal? Just pull up that website. I'll put the link in the notes. I don't know why this is. Literature in the Gospel genre. C.S. Lewis writes, whatever these men may be as biblical critics, I distrust them as critics. They seem to lack any literary judgment. To be imperceptive about the very quality of the text they are reading, it sounds a strange charge to bring against the men who have been steeped in these books all their lives. But that might be just the trouble. A man who has spent his youth and manhood in minute study of New Testament texts and of other people's studies of them, whose literary experience of these texts lacks any standard of comparison such as can only grow from a wide, deep, and genial experience of literature in general, is, I should think, very unlikely to miss the obvious thing about them. If he tells me that something in a gospel is legend or romance, I want to know how many legends or romances he has read, how well his palate is trained in detecting them by the flavor, and how many years he has spent on that gospel. I've been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends, myths, all my life. I know what they are like. I know that not one of them is like this. Of this text, there are only two possible views. Either this is reportage, though it may no doubt contain errors, pretty close up to the facts, nearly as close as Boswell, or else some unknown writer in the second century without known predecessors or successors suddenly anticipated the whole technique of modern novelistic realistic narrative. If it is untrue, it may be narrative of that kind. The reader who doesn't see that is simply not learned to read. That's C.S. Lewis's take on what the Gospels are. And you can read Richard Bauckham's study of Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, where he goes through all the namings. And again, well, it was very interesting in my Sunday school class, just to a group of people who are church-going people. I said, well, what is a gospel? And they worked on things a little bit. And one woman says, well, it's history. Ah, it's history. Now, if you know anything about history, you know that, history itself is a complicated word, but it is history. It is, C.S. Lewis lays this out quite nicely in The Grand Miracle, which is a doodle that you can find on YouTube, or you can read it in C.S. Lewis's book, Miracles. It is a story that fits into the rest of the story and illuminates the world. And now, myths do that, so it is mythological in that sense, but it is also history. And C.S. Lewis goes through the fact that, in fact, it's quite important that the miracles, you can't take out of the miracles out of Christianity like you could out of Islam or Buddhism or just about any other religion, because the miracles function in a particular way in Christianity precisely because it is history. Let me get into this question of reality. Now, one of the great things that I've been picking up by listening to John Vervaeke's class are all the ways that religions provoke mental transformations. There's lots of ways and lots of religions and lots of ways of seeing the events on the ground differently. And John has really helped me understand Christianity and other religions and humanity and cognitive science. Continuing to do that so much better throughout this entire class, where I see all these transformations that happen via texts and rituals and all of these things that he's been laying out. There's lots of ways of modulating the meaning for a particular event. One of the best examples, I think, of this is the movie Life is Beautiful, which I like the movie. I heard a thing with Zizek, who I guess he doesn't like the movie, but Zizek is Zizek. Life is Beautiful is this incredible movie where in the midst of a Nazi death camp, this father tries to spare not only the life of his son, but the mental outlook of his little boy, the anguish of watching all of these people die. And the whole movie is basically him pulling the wool over on German guards one way or another, making his little boy think that this Nazi death camp is actually a big game. And at the end, he might win a prize such as a tank. And if you've never seen the movie, watch the movie. It's an amazing movie. But it in many ways illustrates a lot of the stuff that John Vervaeke is talking about. That there are these transformations that the father is doing on the son in order to reframe all of the events into other events for the son. Okay, so you transform the experience by transforming the story or your experience of the events. And to a great degree, this is what we do with suffering and meaning. There's an event that is causing suffering, and then via meaning, you reframe it, and you can, in fact, then try to eliminate suffering. Now, obviously, with Buddhism, suffering can be caused by the delta of desire and experience, or eliminate expectation, or eliminate desire, and therefore you can eliminate suffering. These are all mental techniques and tricks, not only by individuals, but civilizations. Therefore, you use meaning you leverage meaning in order to reduce suffering, to give meaning and purpose, and to basically help you get through life. And both Peterson and Vervaeke talk about this quite a bit in their own different ways. Now, this is in contrast to the continuous cosmos approach, where you're using agency or power to tailor the story to your liking. And so when Vervaeke is talking about Alexander the Great, he talks about Alexander the Great as kind of a step back to a continuous cosmos approach. Alexander conquers the world and tailors the world to his liking. This Axial Age 2 story. Now, there, somebody had mentioned in the comments, you mean two-story as terms of a house? Yeah. It's also two-story as in terms of the other meaning of story. The story works both ways. You have two stories going on. It's the interaction of those stories. Or it's two stories and a house. And so Alexander the Great, in a sense, says, no, I'm just going to retail. I'm just going to reshape the world according to my liking. Okay. But if you don't have that kind of power or agency in the world, then you default to some of these other techniques where you say, well, my life is, I'm a slave and, I've been sold out by my brothers and I was doing pretty well in Potiphar's house, but then Mrs. Potiphar took a liking to me and she lied about it. And now I'm stuck in jail, but God has a purpose for my life. And that somehow then, helps reduce the suffering if you're poor Joseph stuck in slave prison in Egypt. Now, I haven't really treated yet episode 16, which I know a number of you have asked me to, and I'll probably get around to it. His treatment of Christianity at the end of episode 15 was really quite dramatic, because here he shows how agape is used to transform. And it's not only used to transform the meaning that we attach to events, but it's also actually used to transform people's lives. And so a baby, or the book of Ezekiel has a wonderful story of a king who picks up an abandoned baby and raises her to be queen. Now there's mental transformation and there's physical transformation. And so then we get into recognizing how agape can actually bring physical transformation into this world. And this is why I say that the company, now, a company is not a physical thing. A company has physical aspects around it, but the company itself is not a physical thing, is in some ways more real than the product it made. There's some aspects in which you might say, well, this is more real than the company. The company could go out of business and this thing could endure. Physical things have that quality, but the meaning of this, now it's interesting because I've used this in a number of my videos, I have actually added meaning to this little cell phone holder. It's not actually in the cell phone holder, but let's say someday I become, probably after my death, my videos become enormously famous, and someone finds, you know, maybe my kids need money, and they say, we're going to sell off all the props in Dad's office. And so who wants the cell phone holder that Paul Vanderclay used in his reality video? How about the stapler? You know, maybe $100 for the cell phone holder. We don't even have cell phones anymore. They're implanted in our brains. Maybe 150 for the stapler. One heck of a ripoff at the estate sale at the Vanderclays. But you get my point here, that these transformations happen, and agape is this transformative power that turns slaves into citizens. And in fact, that transformative power over a great number of decades did just that, turn slaves into citizens, you know, both in the medieval period and then in the American period. Now, Christianity also uses axial type two-story cosmology to transform. Jesus says, store up treasures in heaven where moth and rust don't consume. That's what he admonishes. And you're suffering, when you're suffering, you're doing so for the Lord. So Christianity actually uses multiple techniques that other religions use and to reframe the story. It says, okay, so you're living in a death chamber, which is planet Earth. We all die. You're living in a death chamber, and maybe your circumstances within this death chamber are uncomfortable. By virtue of the story, we will transform your experience within this world. Other religions do that too. It also promises change in the events on the ground, and that's where this next level comes into play. The miracles in Christianity are used not only in kind of the traditional way. Miracles were used to show divine favor, to show divine authority upon a person. In fact, I asked my Sunday school class, you know, it's likely nobody in Alexander's period, they knew that his father was Philip of Macedonia, they probably knew exactly who his mother was, yet they called Alexander the Great a son of God. Well, why is Alexander the Great the son of God? Well, because of what he did. And you think, well, that's not how we use son. Right. We tend to think about the word son biologically. In the ancient world, they often used son in terms of authority. All right. And so you'd see the Caesars adopting sons to be Caesar. And Alexander the Great is the son of Philip of Macedonia, and I don't know the mother's name, but they called him a son of God, not because he was born of a god, but because his aspects were godlike. And that's why John Vervaeke says, you know, this is back to the continuous cosmos. Continuous cosmos impression of the world. It's not the right word. So miracles. Well, miracles often are used to demonstrate power, divine authority. And in fact, with Roman Catholicism, now I'll probably get this wrong because I'm not Roman Catholic, but before someone is canonized as a saint, they need to have performed a miracle. And in a sense, it's using miracles in demonstrating divine authority and sanctity. But Jesus used miracles not only for that, but also as signs. And in the Gospel of John, as I go through the Gospel of John in my Sunday school class, we'll call it signs. They're signs of the age to come. They point to the age to come. So water to wine, well, this was showing the abundance of the age to come right there at the wedding of Cana. In a sense, you pull something from the future into the present. You pull something from that age to come into the present. And as I've said before, Christianity tells time in a particularly interesting way. In a sense, you have the present evil age and you have the age to come, but they overlap. And so Christians live in the overlap between the present evil age, the age of decay, as I call it, and then the age to come. That's where Christians live, and that was started at the resurrection of Jesus. And so what Jesus is doing, and you can read C.S. Lewis's miracles about that, miracles of the old creation, miracles of the new creation, I like the way he lays that out. Jesus is showing signs of the reality of the age to come. It's not just power. He's embodying what is to come in what he's showing the people. And now, the greatest miracle then is, well, the resurrection, where his future body and our future bodies come into the present, which is why in the New Testament the apostles keep talking about the end times. We're in the last days because of the resurrection of Jesus. And that gets us back to this word-based reality. What if Jesus' resurrected body is to this world as your alarm clock is to your dream world? I'm going to read that again. What if Jesus' resurrected body is to this world as your alarm clock is to your dream world? Your alarm clock impinges into this world. It is more real than your dream. Jesus' resurrected body does the same in gospel stories. In a sense, so do the loaves and fishes, but not like Jesus' body. And so that's why the New Testament always talks about the last days. The message of Christianity is the promised participation in Jesus' body. Now, meaning it in that case, metaphorically, but that's basically the assertion of 1 Corinthians 15. Now, sometimes people will ask, why do you, Paul, continue to insist in the bodily resurrection of Jesus? It is because of my idea of reality. That just as the alarm clock, or the phone, or the crying baby, or the annoying dog, or the sun opens your eyes and colonizes and invades and temporarily destroys your dream world, well, Jesus' resurrected body invades this world. And, well, it's a greater, it's a deeper level of reality. It's base reality. That's what Christianity says. So, words that fudge, reality and the resurrection.